Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we're going through the Pennsylvania ratification debates. We kind of gave you the inside view, why these are actually the real different ratification debates than the rest of them, and why I kind of like them better. I do like all the information, and I think it's great to have all the information, but 9 times out of 10, every time I go in to try to fix a problem with somebody or with a team, whether this be a complex problem or not, giving them all the information tends to only create opportunities for people to conflate issues, to start going down rat holes, and we lose sight of really what we're trying to do. The reason I like the trimmed no anti-federalist comments, again, is that you got to understand that what the anti-federalists were saying, where they were promoting and calling for, or actually they were saying, hey, they're going to be doing these things. This Constitution is going to let them do things. No, it's not going to let them do those things. If they do those things, they will be violating the Constitution, which is why the Federalists, every time they tried to get away with that, they'd call them back in. No, that power doesn't exist. This is what the power states, and this is what they can do. They can't do that. So it was constantly this game of trying to create a situation like with the militia, what have you. And they just, it became problematic. So this is why I think in Pennsylvania, they wanted to make sure that they didn't retain those things that were being rejected if ultimately the state ratified. And ultimately the state did ratify. Pennsylvania was one of the most contentious. Apparently, it got pretty heated, and it got extended, too. I mean, if you look, they were the first one to convene, and, let me refer to that, and then I forget. I just, where's that information? I got to pull it up again. So Delaware was the first to ratify. Now, Pennsylvania was the second to ratify. They ratified on the 12th. But if I'm looking at the debates, as I have in front of me, because that's what we're reading, and I go into the day that they convened on the 20th. And so that's a good 20-plus days of, debating, where you look at some of the other states in 1 week. Some of the other states, the ones that had the contentious debates where there was a lot of contention, okay, it took a while. But Pennsylvania, it was pretty contentious. I think Massachusetts was very contentious as well. I think Virginia, very contentious. When we get to the Carolinas, it was really about slavery. And the fact is, when you reason why it wasn't as long and they weren't as contentious, I believe, and I'm just giving you my assessment, is when you really look at what they're saying, they go, look, you're looking at a gift horse. If you don't take this gift, then, and we come back and we don't go into the Constitution, they say, hey, those guys never came in anyway. Why did you even worry about maintaining, making these compromises over slavery? And they get rid of slavery, then when we come back, we're going to have to give it up. If we get in now, we get to keep it, at least based on these parameters. We get to keep it. So, it's kind of like what Hamilton was doing in New York. And New York kind of just went on, and I think Hamilton kind of exacerbated the whole why it went extra long, because they had to spend a couple of days on dealing with the behavior of Hamilton, and I think it was Langston or Livingston or Lansing. I think it was Lansing. Anyway. Back to the Pennsylvania debates. But before I do, let me remind you that we do have a champion for the Constitution in the election this year in Missouri, and he could use your support. His name is Gerald Winstrand. Wistrand, I'm sorry. Not Winstrand. Wistrand. Wistrand. I think I spelled that right. Anyway, am I right there, Sean? Is that right?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. All right. We are in the Pennsylvania debates. We're on the 1st of December. We just finished the regular taxation reading of the little highlight for that. Now we're going to read the necessary and proper highlight. This is where he addresses the necessary and proper clause. So let's go ahead and take it off from there. Thank you.
The gentleman in opposition strongly insists that the general clause at the end of the 8th section gives to Congress a power of legislating generally, but I cannot conceive by what means he will render the words susceptible of that expansion. Can the words, quote, the Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper to carry into execution the foregoing powers, end quote, be capable of giving them general legislative power? I hope that is not meant to give Congress merely an elusive show of authority to deceive themselves or constituents any longer. On the contrary, I trust it is meant that they shall have the power of carrying into effect the laws which they shall make under the powers vested in them by this Constitution. In answer to the gentleman from Fayette, Mr. Smiley, on the subject of the press, I beg leave to make an observation. It is very true, sir, that this Constitution says nothing with regard to that subject, nor was it necessary, because it would be found that there is given to the general government no power whatsoever concerning it, and no law in pursuance of the Constitution can possibly be enacted to destroy that liberty.
There you go. So, in other words, I have this little comment underneath that, you probably see that, no general. In other words, there's no general powers. They're very specific, and all laws must be derivatives of the powers granted, not implied. They have to be derivative of powers granted, because one can sit there, that's the whole point of necessary and proper. If necessary and proper didn't have that little clause at the very end of it that basically said to carry into execution the foregoing powers, that very specific add-on, that's the language. There's no semicolon between the necessary and proper to carry into execution the foregoing powers. That is a part of the necessary and proper clause. Not to, you know, figure out whatever you think necessary and proper. This is where John Marshall started actually removing that to carry into execution and just said, hey, the federal government could start doing things necessary and proper. John Marshall knew and understood that necessary and proper only applied to the creation of laws that as derived by those powers. And he actually started aggrandizing. So it wasn't through the Constitution that this idea of necessary and proper became, you know, out of control. It was by a nefarious, because we all, this is why we covered the Federalist Papers. And when we get to Virginia, you're going to see John Marshall literally make claims and assertions regarding this Constitution that directly conflict with some of his own rulings and opinions. But you got to remember, he was a protege of Alexander Hamilton. So he was like, these guys are kind of like Islam, this art of deception. It's not a lie if it's for a better cause. If it's to further their control over government, then it's not a lie. Like Islam, it's not a lie if it furthers the cause of Islam.
Ends justify the means.
There you go. Right. Okay. And that's a communist paradigm. That is a fascist paradigm. Okay. So the next one we want to cover is amendment. This one little note on amendment on that same day. Go ahead.
I beg to make one remark on what one gentleman has said with respect to amendments being proposed to this Constitution. To whom are the conventions to make report of such amendments? He tells you to the present Congress. I do not wish to report to that body, the representatives only of the state governments. They may not be disposed to admit the people into a participation of their power. It has also been supposed that a wonderful unanimity subsists among those who are enemies to the proposed system. On this point, I also differ from the gentleman who made the observation. I have taken every pain in my power and read every publication I could meet with in order to gain information. And as far as I have been able to judge, the opposition is inconsiderable and inconsistent. Instead of agreeing in their objections, those who make them bring forward such as are diametrically opposite. Instead of agreeing in their objections, those who make them bring forward such as are diametrically opposite. On one hand, it is said that the representation in Congress is too small. On the other hand, it is said to be too numerous. Some think the authority of the Senate too great, some that the House of Representatives, and some that of both. Others draw their fears from the powers of the president, and, like the iron race of Cadmus, these opponents rise only to destroy each other.
Now, if you keep going, because he kind of gets long-winded on this, but bottom line, the Constitution actually has a system that would work in providing two paths. Congress can actually make suggestions for amendments. Out of all of the, and then there's this path of convention where the states can actually petition to have their own convention. Here's the real question that you need to ask. How many amendments to the Constitution originated by the states requesting instead of Congress suggesting?
I do not have that information, sir.
Do you remember covering it when we went through the Constitution last year? We did actually cover it. I do it every year. Over half. Well over half. We got 28 amendments. Well over half of all the amendments came from the states. When we got 12 amendments that came out of the very beginning, and 11 of those passed. We know that the 11th Amendment, which is now the 12th of the 11 for the Bill of Rights. Remember, the 27th Amendment was the second amendment in the Bill of Rights. So we got the 10 of the Bill of Rights, and then we've got the one that's 27, then 11. So that right there is 12 out of 28 amendments. Now, people don't count the original 13, but I do. The 12th Amendment was actually provided by Congress because they didn't want to see a elongated choosing of the president that they went through in 1800. So they changed the process of the Electoral College very slightly. Okay, so that's the 12th Amendment. The 13th Amendment actually came from the states because they started seeing the English bar and the English influences into the laws of the states. So they basically started saying, hey, we want this nobility clause in the Constitution expanded and make it so that lawyers can no longer be citizens if they're a part of that bar. Voila. So we got that out of the states, but there's what is that, the 13th now, right? We said 12 because the 11th Amendment meant the 12th. Because the original Bill of Rights, 11 is the 12th. So the 13th becomes the 13th. So now we have the Lincoln Amendment, which was basically an amendment by Lincoln, not by Congress, that ending slavery. Because remember, I believe he had to pull Congress together to pass the 13th Amendment. And that was a limited Congress, not a full Congress. But when we look at the 14th Amendment, that was done by Congress. So the 12th and Lincoln's, you know, what is it, the Emancipation or the freeing of the slaves, the 14th Amendment. Then the 15th Amendment was voting. So quickly the Congress did that one. That was the only voting amendment done by Congress because all of their voting amendments. No, there was another one. It was the poll tax was done by Congress as well because there were some states that were doing that. And the federal government just took lead on that. But the states would have actually supported that. Nevertheless, as we look at some of the other amendments, though, we know that the 17th Amendment came from the states. Believe it or not, the states were deliberately not seating senators. And so the states basically said, hey, they're not seating their senators. We need to change the process. So that actually came from the states. So the 15th and the 16th Amendment was kind of driven by the government's hand, or I should say the federal government's hand. So the 17th, then the 18th, which was what? Prohibition? What's the 18th?
I think it was Prohibition. Or was that 19?
I think 19 is women's suffrage. I think 19 is women's suffrage. I think. So, hate to have dead air here.
You're the expert, sir.
I get it.
Just the assistant.
Oh, I know that. I know that. So let me pull up the color-coded Constitution. And as I look at, because I'll just do it this way quickly. So the 17th Amendment, we know what that was, the suffrage in the Senate. That was done by the states. The 18th was the, prohibition. That came from the states as well. So that's two more for the states. So we went to 13, 14, 15. Right now, we already have over the half. The repealing of the prohibition is another one, so we know that that's well beyond that. And we know that women's suffrage came from the states. We know that suffrage for 18-year-olds came from the states as well. So we're well over half already. We can drill into the other ones. Where are the origins of these? And we'll probably find that some of those actually came from nefarious entities and so forth, but nevertheless, over half of the amendments we have came from the states. Came from the states requesting Congress to give them an amendment. Why didn't those states just go ahead and start playing with petitioning? Because back in those days, there wasn't these, financial opportunities like we have with NGOs and nonprofits and so forth. They weren't playing in the nonprofit world. That's kind of a more of a modern thing. And now there's money in creating an entity to try to actually convince us. And there's a lot of global money going into that effort. And when I say global, I'm talking about billionaires. Billionaires that are being duped on all sides, trying to convince that we have a convention of states. So there's real problems with that. And we dive into that, every year, and I'll just leave it at that. So bottom line, so he's talking about this amendment and these processes of the amendment, and the reality is that they have a mechanism, two mechanisms, and technically it's three. Congress on its own can recommend. The states can actually suggest, and it would be in Congress's best interest, those men in Congress, to say, you know what, our state's supporting this. You don't need to petition for a convention. You only need to petition a good idea. There's never been a time where there's been a majority of states asking for an amendment that they didn't get it. Never. And they say, oh, well, we've been asking for term limits. That's because there's not that many states that are actually asking for term limits. There may be people out there believing in term limits. But as you suggested, it doesn't solve the problem because term limits, it isn't the problem. Whether they serve or not, how does that change whether they can violate the Constitution or not? They're violating the Constitution now. So if we term them out, new people go in. What did we do to actually keep them from violating the Constitution like the guys in there before?
Nothing.
Nothing. There you go. We've just basically brought in more opportunities for people to get themselves rich. We've created a better revolving door, and I get it. People really hate these long-term millionaires, but it helps people start understanding that, they don't have the authority to be doing these things, and they should not be getting rich like that. If we would have had term limits, a lot of that stuff would be suppressed because you wouldn't have these people walking away with hundreds of millions of dollars in their pockets because of their long-term
collecting service. All this power.
Correct. Correct. And have a husband lobbyist like Pelosi or like Feinstein and others. Anyway. Okay.
We imposed term limits Saturday.
What's that?
And I said Louisiana imposed term limits Saturday.
Oh, in the election? You guys imposed that?
Yeah. We voted his butt out.
Okay. All right. So if you scroll down a little bit further, there's more to this. So we want to kind of read the next part of this. So go ahead.
Are we on slave?
No. We're just above that. Oh, yeah. Okay. So we are on slave. I'm sorry. We are on slave. Yes. My bad.
No problem. Much fault has been found with the mode of expression used in the first clause of the ninth section of the first article. I believe I can assign a reason why that mode of expression was used. and why the term slave was not admitted in this Constitution. And as to the manner of laying taxes, this is not the first time that the subject has come into the view of the United States and of the legislatures of the several states. The gentleman, Mr. Finley, will recollect that in the present Congress, the quota of the federal debt and general expenses was to be in proportion to the value of the land and other enumerated property within states. After trying this for a number of years, it was found on all hands to be a mode that could not be carried into execution. Congress were satisfied of this, and in the year 1783 recommended, in conformity with the powers they possessed under the Articles of Confederation, that the quota should be according to the number of free people, including those bound to servitude and excluding Indians not taxed. These were the expressions used in 1783, and the fate of this recommendation was similar to all other resolutions. It was not carried into effect, but it was adopted by no fewer than 11 out of 13 states. And it cannot but be a matter of surprise to hear gentlemen who agreed to the very mode of expression at that time come forward and state it as an objection to the present occasion. It was natural, sir, for the late convention to adopt the mode after it had been agreed to by 11 states, and to use the expression which they found had been received as unexceptional before.
Okay, so guess what? Mr. Finley got an opportunity to live in infamy because he was just called out by saying, hey, you know, why are you guys using those terms? When he actually just basically pulled out all this information, provided the facts and the history behind it, and that he had the hand in doing it. And now he's got a problem with it after he already did it into the Articles of Confederation. Oh, boy, be careful. Sometimes, you know, people remember what you did, and they, you, boom. Oh, yeah. I love this. This right here is what we call karma. Coming uppins. Yeah. You think we forgot that you were the ones that did this? Because he was actually in the convention, and I remember when this was brought up, because it was kind of an epiphany to me. And I go, wow. And now seeing this again, this, like I said, this is just being highlighted again. And this is great. This is great, because here these... those who were enjoying taking advantage of the ineptitude and the impotence of the Articles of Confederation and basically gaining significant commercial advantages, Pennsylvania, New York, Virginia, all of the bigger states, they were all gaining advantages over the little states. And so why would they want to give this up? Why would they want to break this up? The little states were smart. Let's get off of this, because now nobody gets any advantages. There's no more preferences to states. We're all going to have an equal opportunity, an equal, you know, drink from the well, so to speak. Anyway, okay. So now slavery and new states. Let's go ahead and dive into this. Thanks.
With respect to the clause restricting Congress from prohibiting the migration or importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit prior to the year 1808, the honorable gentleman said that this clause is not only dark, but intended to grant to Congress for that time the power to admit the importation of slaves. No such thing was intended, but I will tell you what was done. And it gives me high pleasure that so much was done. Under the present Confederation, the states may admit the importation of slaves as long as they please. But by this article, after the year 1808, the Congress will have power to prohibit such importation, notwithstanding the disposition of any state to the contrary.
Okay, so right there, we'll take a break. Because I, again, didn't notice that time was down to nothing. I'm just enjoying this, folks. So right there, and this is one of those contributions that really talks about how the Constitution was designed to actually get rid of slavery. We will be right back as we dive back into this. Thank you so much.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Sorry about that, Sean. Forgive me.
Oh, no problem, sir.
Okay, so you kind of you left off with that last, and it actually is kind of important. So I'd hate to have you read that again, but I will tell you that what was done, because as he starts setting the stage, because right there he's setting the stage of what was going to happen. So reading that in context to what they do here is really, really beneficial. And I know you'll love this because, you know, as you start seeing these things coming out, how they're professing that these things would have curbed slavery to basically extinction in America under the Constitution. That's what I don't want to jump the gun. You tell me what he ends up saying through these debates, but go ahead.
I consider this as laying the foundation for banishing slavery out of this country. And though the period is more distant than I could wish, yet it will produce the same kind gradual change which was pursued in Pennsylvania. It is with much satisfaction I view this power in the general government, whereby they may lay an interdiction on this reproachful trade. But an immediate advantage is also obtained, for a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person, and this, sir, operates as a partial prohibition. It was all that could be attained. I'm sorry it was no more, but from this I think there is reason to hope that yet a few years and it will be prohibited altogether. And in the meantime, the new states which are to be formed will be under the control of Congress in this particular, and slaves will never be introduced amongst them. The gentleman says that it is unfortunate in another point of view. It means to prohibit the introduction of white people from Europe, as this tax may deter them from coming amongst us. A little impartiality and attention will discover the care that the convention took in selecting their language. The words are, quote, the migration or importation of such persons, etc., shall not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year 1808. But a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, end quote. It is observable here that the term migration is dropped when a tax or duty is mentioned, so that Congress have power to impose tax only on those imported.
Okay, and then they only have the ability to regulate those migrating. In other words, they can't dictate who can migrate, but they can dictate whether they can migrate or not. In other words, they have no control over immigration. The states have all that control. But the whole point of this wasn't really to regulate immigration at all. It was the whole point was to shut down the slave trade. Because after 1808, that's exactly what happened. People still came to America. And it didn't mean that there were taxes placed on white people that came in or indentured servants. Only those who were bought into, you know, permanent bondage. So, in other words, this was literally the process of forcing slavery into exile in America. Because once they couldn't get slaves into America anymore, they were dependent on creating their own slaves. And with attrition and the expanse and everything else, they knew they couldn't keep up. So what would ultimately happen is states would start joining the union because the slave plantations couldn't proliferate fast enough going into these new states. By 1820, Missouri was coming online, and it was going to be because there were too few plantations. They didn't have enough slaves to actually start expanding to make these plantations flourish the way they wanted to. So they saw that Missouri was actually going to decide for itself whether it was going to be slave, and because there was very little slave franchises in Missouri, that they were very afraid, and they knew that the people didn't want to have slavery. They didn't like it. They didn't see it bringing any value to Missouri. Therefore, that's one of the reasons why the process behind the doors of politics in D.C. and throughout the existing states, they started funneling opportunities or money throughout the, you know, these back doors to get everybody to agree that they're going to start inflicting slavery upon all these southern states. And that's what the Missouri Compromise was. It had nothing to do with Missouri wanting to be a slave state. It had everything to do with ensuring Missouri would become a slave state. Because when you look at Missouri, Missouri is north of the Mason-Dixon line. It sits on top of it. And based on the Mason-Dixon line, it couldn't get in there. But they wanted to make sure because there was already a heavy investment. I should say there was already substantial investment enough that they wanted to see because Missouri was a huge fertile pasture land. I mean, there's not a lot of big mountains in Missouri. Lots of great agricultural opportunities. And it was a huge state right there with the Missouri and the Mississippi close by. Lots of commerce opportunities. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, that right there basically started everything going down this path of saying we now just beat what the creator had put into the Constitution in getting rid of slavery. We now undermined it. There you go. And that had nothing to do with what the Anti-Federalists said or what have you. It had everything to do with corruption and violations to the Constitution, because for them to inflict slavery upon a state, where would you need to actually, a new state coming into the Union, where would you need to put that language so that these certain states would have to become slave states? That has to be in the Constitution, or the federal government can't do it, right?
Right.
Okay. Any idea where that would go?
Nowheres.
Article 4. Article 4, Section 3 is where they would need to amend the Constitution to be able to constitutionally inflict that, to basically say, in admitting new states, in addition to Congress having the ability to create, you know, rules and regulations of the territory, allow, they need to insert some words to say Congress can also ensure, or basically Congress by this act has now, or they would just put the language of the act that all states joining the Union from this point to this point in latitude, then those states will be slave states. That right there would basically galvanize legitimately those states being slave states. The federal government and Congress cannot and could not do what they did. It had to be in the Constitution, and that's the only place they could have done it, right there where new states would be admitted. But again, that power wasn't granted, and Congress assumed that power. That's why it was all done unconstitutionally, folks. All done unconstitutionally. All right, so the next one, we're going to skip down to December 3rd. And we're going to look at, actually, no, December 4th on enumerated. This is where Mr. Wilson is going to go through these different ideas. And the first one is enumerated powers. So let's dive into that.
A good deal has already been said concerning a Bill of Rights. I have stated, according to the best of my recollection, all that passed in convention relating to that business. Since that time, I have spoken with a gentleman who has not only his memory, but full notes that he had taken in that body, and he assures me that, upon this subject, no direct motion was ever made at all. And certainly, before we heard this so violently supported out of doors, some pains ought to have been taken to have tried its fate within. But the truth is, a Bill of Rights would, as I have mentioned already, have been not only unnecessary, but improper. In some governments, it may come within the gentleman's idea when he says it can do no harm. But even in these governments, you find bills of rights do not uniformly obtain, and do those states complain who have them not? It is a maxim in forming governments that not only all the powers which are given, but also all those which are reserved should be enumerated. I apprehend that the powers given in reserve form the whole rights of the people as men and citizens. I consider that there are very few who understand the whole of these rights. All the political writers, from Grotius and Pufendorf down to Vattel, have treated on this subject, but in no one of those books, nor in the aggregate of them all, can you find a complete enumeration of the rights appertaining to the people as men and as citizens.
Okay, so right there, that's kind of a common, you know, who has the brilliance of being able to list all of the rights that we want to protect? Because as technology, computers, and all these types of things that they couldn't fathom, now we need to extend those rights. Well, I believe the Bill of Rights that were written were that, the insights were there. Because when we look at the right of being secure in your person, your papers, effects, and things, that includes computers. I mean, the way the Bill of Rights were done, because it was truly inspired, and it was truly done in a tranquil, not under this, you know, well, we're not going to join unless you give us these rights. We're not going to do, you know, putting the Constitution, getting it ratified first was paramount. The only reason, I'll just say this, folks, the only reason those Bill of Rights became necessary at that point in time, because I don't believe that the circumstances, the men and the nation would have been willing to actually make how many amendments to the Constitution other than the 14th Amendment after slavery and after the Civil War. I think that the man or the creator, our God, understood the circumstances of the time. And he knew and foresaw and made sure that that 14th Amendment came forward. Congress started it off as a Civil Rights Act, the 1806 Civil Rights Act, and it failed. Or it didn't fail. It got vetoed, and then they overcame the veto, and then Jackson laughed and said, it's an act. It has no constitutional standing. I don't have to enforce that. So good job on you. He just stood there. Here's your Pyrrhus victory, and applauded them. So now Congress, being really upset, took everything from the bill, from the Civil Rights Act, and they got quickly started on an amendment that they started in March, and by June they had that amendment done and out to the states that fast. If you look at the extent, you could tell that they were already prepared because it came from this thing called the Civil Rights Act. But they added a lot of things, and Section 3 was one of those things that they added. Anyway,
what was the year on that Civil Rights Act you're talking about?
What's that?
You said there was a year of that Civil Rights Act.
1866.
That was the origins of the 14th Amendment.
1866. That it was passed Congress in, I think, January. I think early February. The president vetoed it, and they overcame
Jackson.
That. Johnson. Andrew Johnson.
Johnson.
Now, this one right here, the next part of what you're going to read is where he actually lays out and emphatically lays out this concept of general powers. That, you know, in these constitutions with general powers, they're problematic. You got to have a Bill of Rights. So go ahead and read the remaining part of this. Thanks.
There are two kinds of government. That where general powers intended to be given to the legislature, and that where the powers are particularly enumerated. In the last case, the implied result is that nothing more is intended to be given than what is so enumerated, unless it results from the nature of the government itself. On the other hand, when general legislative powers are given, then the people part with their authority, and on the gentleman's principle of government, retain nothing. But in a government like the proposed one, there can be no necessity for a Bill of Rights. for on my principle, the people never part with their power.
Okay. So he's laying it out there that there is no general powers, that this is strictly enumerated. They only have the ability to do this and this. So it's another way of saying that we don't have to worry about a Bill of Rights, folks. The government can only do these things, and that's it. Now, does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, great. Great. Because
I totally agree with the no necessity. I think that it created problems in the future because now people say, oh, well, this is a right, and that's a right. And they have no fundamental definition of exactly what that means.
Right. And then
but everything's a right now.
Yes. And you turn right around and ask them, well, do they have the power to create roads and highways and waterways and airways? They say, well, of course they do. No, they don't. So you're more concerned about things that they shouldn't be doing to you that technically they're not in most cases, but you have no idea what they shouldn't be doing, and they're getting away with that. And let me ask you this. How much money in the past decade, two decades, have we spent on boondoggles in trying to bolster our transportation, or I should say, our infrastructure? I can tell
most
you
of it.
Trillions, trillions and trillions. They had special bills. Biden had a multi-trillion dollar deal for the infrastructure. Obama had a huge infrastructure deal. Even Clinton had a big infrastructure deal. Probably Bush Jr. did, too. All of them do. Oh, we're going to improve the And since then, we've had nothing but train wrecks with, you know, spilling poisonous crap all over the place because our infrastructure is sorely in need of refurbishment. But the problem is the federal government has no responsibility for it. So guess what? When the states realize that the federal government shouldn't be doing it, do you think the states are going to sit there and let those railroad bridges, you know, be operated without being refurbished first? That means that, hey, those companies riding on that, they're going to have to help pitch in and get these things fixed. Because those are private companies, right?
Yes, yeah. Sir.
Or you're not flowing that commerce through this state. Because the federal government can't make the state allow that to happen. They can actually, you know, ensure that those lines have to be safe. But my point is, folks, and this is why, you know, I would highly point out the video we have on the Department of Transportation, because it's a perfect example of how government has spent trillions and trillions of dollars. Trump did. I mean, Trump just did a big, huge infrastructure bill, right? It was, what, $2-some-odd trillion dollars on top of whatever was in their budget. On top of whatever was in their budget, they were getting boosted again. This is all a scam. That money doesn't go. Obama spent, I don't know how many billions, look it up. How many billions of dollars did Obama get funded to put high-speed fiber internet throughout the rural areas of America? And I remember when I was traveling through the rural areas of America in 2014, 2015, and so forth, there were all sorts of vehicles I found in different states and different, you know, these obscure little state highways where they were laying this orange fiber, this orange, you know, line, which was literally fiber. They were running it. They weren't connecting it. And they weren't connecting the node. They weren't putting nodes in to connect these points. They were just spending the money and going out there, and nobody was actually, there was no whistleblower to say, you know what we're doing, it's not going to work. It's not being intended to work. We're just wasting your money. So that they could actually show that they did that, but the majority of the money actually went into the pockets of the loyalists. And that's how it's done. Anyway, anything else to add to this right here?
No, sir.
All right. So as we go down to the next one, the Supreme and Sovereignty and Supreme, which is the next one. There's two of these. Let's do this first, Supreme and Sovereignty, on the 4th of December.
In this confederated republic, the sovereignty of the states, it is said, is not preserved. We are told that there cannot be two sovereign powers and that a subordinate sovereignty is no sovereignty. It will be worthwhile, Mr. President, to consider this objection at large. When I had the honor of speaking formally on this subject, I stated in as concise a manner as possible the leading ideas that occurred to me. To ascertain where the supreme and sovereign power resides, it is not then, nor I presume will it be denied, that somewhere there is, and of necessity must be, a supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority. This, I believe, may justly be termed the sovereign power. For, from that gentleman's, Mr. Finley's, account of the matter, it cannot be sovereign unless it is supreme. For, says he, a subordinate sovereignty is no sovereignty at all. I had the honor of observing that if the question was asked where the supreme power resided, different answers would be given by different writers. I mentioned that Blackstone will tell you that in Britain, it is lodged in British Parliament, and I believe there is no writer on the subject on the other side of the Atlantic, but suppose it to be vested in that body. I stated further that if the question was asked of some politician who had not considered the subject with sufficient accuracy, where the supreme power resided in our governments, he would answer that it was vested in the state constitutions. This opinion approaches near the truth, but does not reach it. For the truth is that the supreme, absolute, and uncontrollable authority remains with the people. I mentioned also that the practical recognition of this truth was reserved for the honor of this country. I recollect no constitution founded on this principle, but we have witnessed the improvement and enjoy the happiness of seeing it carried into practice. The great and penetrating mind of Locke seems to be the only one that pointed toward even the theory of this great truth.
Okay, so here he's talking about this uniqueness, and he's not connecting the dots. I think it's great that he's really pointing out about the sovereignty. When we really start talking, and there's no context, I mean, if people haven't read this, and we're sitting here talking about who are the sovereigns of our government, undoubtedly, it would be we the people. Everybody would say, we the people, when actually this government was framed by the sovereigns. When I say sovereigns, it wasn't just we the people. We actually, by this point in time, had governments, and these governments became sovereigns. And the governments that were operating at this point in time and creating the U.S. Constitution were the state governments. They were acting on our behalf. They had the power to do so. They created the Articles of Confederation. And the Articles of Confederation were so inept and so impotent that they had to fix it. So they set up a meeting for a convention to address the exigencies of the Union by saving the Union. And they sent delegates and empowered them to go do just this thing. And ergo, the sovereignty of the state stepped in to present a government to save us, to basically abandon the Articles of Confederation. But before doing so, they folded in all of those key things and improved upon them in so many ways that we could look, we wouldn't have to look back. And yet today it frustrates me that we have people constantly point, we got to go back to the Articles of Confederation. It's almost like saying that I gotta get a, you know, there's these things called degaussers, and a degausser will basically erase electronic information on electronic media, you know, such as tapes, such as discs, and so forth. What we have is information that we use. And so if there was such a thing to put on somebody's minds to literally wipe out all of their memory in their head, literally expunge all the memory so they'd start all over again, that would be tantamount to going back to the Articles of Confederation. Because it would even be worse than that. It wouldn't be just, you know, because we wouldn't have the lessons learned. They would be starting all over again, because how many people are going to talk about those amendments that were needed? They don't even talk about that. They don't talk about the 8 amendments that they couldn't get passed to get the job, to get the Articles of Confederation even functioning and firing on one cylinder. And yet they're screaming that that is the original, the only legitimate. You know what? These people do not know what they're talking about. And I don't mean to insult them. They've bought into, I'll just say, a bunch of propaganda that was so well framed that they failed themselves to do the due diligence, which the people that were selling them this idea didn't do, because the states did legitimately realize that the Articles of Confederation were defunct. They did create this convention legitimately. They did actually bring this Constitution back legitimately. We've already covered this. It was not a runaway convention like Mr. Brown and the John Birch Society and all these other people out there telling you this. These guys are subject matter experts that there was a runaway convention. And we've gone through these commissions. There's nowhere there that didn't tell them that they couldn't present an idea of a different government because they couldn't fix the Articles of Confederation. They felt it necessary to do such an overhaul of the Articles of Confederation to create, again, they tucked in all of these points of the Articles of Confederation, and they improved upon it. They improved upon it in so many ways that the people that are espousing, you know, this runaway convention don't even understand. I mean, they don't challenge the unconstitutional exertions of power of the courts. They'll stand up and they'll basically say, oh, the president doesn't have the power to create law. But where are they in championing and shutting down the courts? Well, that's interesting. I can go on and on and on. But the fact is, folks, that in reading these documents, this clarifies it. You can't walk away understanding anything but what the real truth is. That when we look at, you know, this right here, the sovereignty of the states created this Constitution, and the sovereignty of the people selected their delegates in a Republican form of government. They sent their delegates to go debate it, even though many of the people that they elected were the same people. I mean, those people that would put their names on a ballot were the educated ones. It wasn't, you know, hey, let me just step into the ring. I don't know how to spell. I can't even sign my name because I'm illiterate. But I want to go and do this. None of those people stepped into that. It was always the who's who of politics of the time. So even though it wasn't done by the current legislature, there were other people out there that were selected, and they were told what to do. And then when they went into the debates, the anti-federalists did everything they could. They lied and they misrepresented. They conflated. They obviated. They did everything they could to kill this Constitution dead so that they could continue their heyday in preserving the powers that they've obtained as states, these six states, trying to protect their base of power. And thank God that the truth resounded throughout these debates where they could actually clarify what was going on, what was going down, and therefore we got the Constitution ratified, uncontested, or I should say, unanimously. There wasn't a state that didn't ratify. Well, with that, obviously, we've kind of ran out of time. And so I guess that's kind of a good segue into ending. But when we come back, we're going to pick up a second view of Mr. Wilson talking about sovereignty and supremacy, so that we can kind of reinvigorate ourselves in tomorrow's show. So anyway, folks, we'll be back. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. We need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.